Anybody has any thoughts or what is your understanding of this impasse that they are talking about in the paper? Mark? Okay. Hiro?
So, Susie was originally motivated to solve the hierarchy problem. That's low energy supersymmetry. So, as you said before, I guess, you assume scale of Susie greatly is near scale of electrically symmetry greatly. And I guess one of the other attractive features of Susie was that it naturally produces dark matter candidate, which is the lightest neutrino in the scale of parity. So, but the point is that dark matter, you have like constraints, like observational constraints, like relic abundance, which is like omega h squared is about equal to 0.11.
Yeah, look at these numbers. So the first equation of this paper is to say that this number has been measured by WMAP to this high precision.
So essentially, I guess the papers say, taking experimental constraints into account, how natural it is for low energy CUV to produce like a viable dark matter candidate, and like how much you have to tune in, and what composition it must be, which is like Eno, Neo, something between the Neo and the Zeno.
So why is there an impasse now? And there was an impasse before. Like what was determining why supersymmetric dark matter is in an impasse in 2006?
Was it an observation?
Observation. WMAP measured this very precisely, but the impasse comes from LEP. Okay, the Large Electron Positron Collider was a very, very nice, clean machine, leptonic machine. So it measured a lot of things, and it bounded new physics at the Lull level, because LEP was able to measure things at the percent level. It was also able to bound new physics in the Lull level. And using that, after LEP, the situation of supersymmetry after LEP is that the scale of supersymmetry breaking has to be larger than the scale of electrophobic symmetry breaking. So the impasse comes from, again, data, very precise data coming from LEP. Before LEP, the prediction for supersymmetry is that we will see supersymmetric particles in this collider. People were very excited about producing these supersymmetric particles. The same that we were very excited about Evatron producing supersymmetric particles, and it didn't happen. And we are now very excited about the NHC producing supersymmetric particles. But after LEP, we know that the scale of supersymmetry breaking is not around the electrophobic scale, but somehow higher. So the idea of supersymmetry is that the lightest supersymmetric particle, the LSP, is dark matter. This is the lightest supersymmetric particle. And this dark matter is generally a neutralino, the lightest neutralino. So you remember we wrote down what is the mass matrix for the neutralino, and I told you, well, it has this block structure. It has M1, the Gechino mass for the Vino, M2, the Wino mass. Then it has this structure, minus mu, 0, 0. And then it has these pieces here of electrophobic symmetry breaking. So things that depend on the Z mass. And I told you, well, so you can assume that M1, M2, and mu are actually much bigger than the electrophobic symmetry breaking pieces. Why did I tell you this? It's because I already know that from LEP, LEP is imposing bounds on the neutralinos that pushes them to be higher than the electrophobic scale. LEP was a machine exploring the electrophobic scale, the Z mass, and didn't see any supersymmetric particles. And you may remember that when you assume this, so you forget about these entries here, the eigenvalues are very simple. There is a Majorana guy that is mostly a Vino that has mass M1, another Majorana Gichino, that is mostly W, and then there is a Dirac guy with mass mu, and it's made up of the Higgsino up and Higgsino down. So remember we did that. Some point we diagonalize this mass matrix in the limit where the electroweak symmetry breaking entries are much smaller than the supersymmetry breaking entries. Okay, so the impasse for that matter in this paper is just a realization that this expected result of supersymmetry would be discovered and left didn't happen, which sets some bounds on the scale of supersymmetry breaking, but it also has implications on that matter. Did you read anything else? Did anybody read the paper at all? You know, you didn't? Oh, but it's still you read a little bit. Did you get to the point where they discuss different? So now, the possibilities for neutralino are very clear. They are either Beano-like, or Wino-like, or Higgsino-like, or a combination. There's no more possibilities. So did you get into why each of them, so if it's purely Beano, purely Wino, or purely Higgsino, we are in trouble? No. The idea is that, okay, so to reproduce this number, I have to start with some dark matter in the early universe and produce enough annihilations as to end up with this relic abundance. So if the dark matter particle interacts very strongly, it will annihilate a lot, and it won't be able to explain this number. It will be underabundant. If the dark matter interacts very, very weakly, then it will produce an overabundance, and it won't be able to explain this number. So what this paper realized is that a neutralino, an LSP, that is purely Wino, will interact or will decay into standard model particles. So let's say I do Wino, that produces a standard model. This is the computation we did for the relic abundance. So if it's a Wino, the interaction is order G prime, and G prime is a small number, it's much smaller than the G, so this is not efficient. And a typical prediction of Beano dark matter is an overabundance at the end of the day, because you are not destroying Beanos in the early universe fast enough. So that's problematic. On the other side of the spectrum, we have the pure Wino or Higgsino. These guys do exactly the same thing, but now with G is much bigger than G prime. So this destroying this dark matter is very efficient, actually too efficient. So in the pure Wino or Higgsino case, you end up with too less of dark matter. There is too little of dark matter to explain the relic abundance. So this guy says, okay, so now after LEP, I know my dark matter candidate is kind of heavy. I can neglect possible mixtures with electroweak entries. So it's going to be a pure state, pure gauge state, or Higgsino state. If I just assume this, I'm going to have a not efficient situation. If I do Wino or Higgsino, it's too efficient, and it is very, very difficult to explain WMAP data. So what do you think we can do now? I have a situation where I get too much random matter. Another possibility where I get too little. What, as a particle physicist, what would you do with that? Yes, and in such a balance that I get the exact right quantity. This is the impasse. The impasse is that I need to explain dark matter abundance. I do need to imagine that it is a particular combination, a fine-tuned combination, of Beano, Higgsino, and Wino. plasmino. And this is what they call the well-tempered neutralino. To produce this, it has to be well-tempered to be done, okay? So it is what these guys are saying is, this is very important because you are already wondering about this kind of hierarchy. You are saying because super left bounds are pushing supersymmetric particles to be heavy, I'm already worrying about the hierarchy problem. You should also be worrying about this fine tuning here. Yes.
Somewhat abundant. Like even if it's not, you can't match it, it should still be there. You know, it should maybe screw up cosmological observations because it's very accurate still.
Right, so you could go two ways. You could, if you get a dark matter particle that is overabundant, you are screwed. If you get less dark matter relic density than this number, you can always claim that this is not the only source of dark matter in the universe and there are other sectors. You can always try to solve that.
But if you're over, it's bad.
Yeah, you are down. Because
you've just seen something. Okay.
All right, so that was the point of this paper, is to say that if you worry about this as well. Yes?
As we're talking about dark matter candidates, when we saw the gravitino yesterday,
the gravitino.
Does that have any properties that might be good for dark matter, or if not, why not?
So it's massive. It could be the lightest supersymmetric particle, and because of our parity, it would be stable, and it's neutral, so we are all fine. Gravitino is another candidate for dark matter.
It's been 3 hours,
yes, it will change the computation, yes.
But they don't talk about that in this paper.
No, in that case, they were assuming in the MSSM. Okay, yeah. Like the gravitino dark matter is a good possibility. We are going to see it today. If you have gauge mediation or low scalar, supersymmetric breaking, hidden sector that is nearly. So we are going to see why gravitino is not the simplest option. Okay, so one point. So this paper was written in 2006. And the only piece of data they are using to constrain, you know, dark matter scenarios is this WMAP. Do we have more data and more information about dark matter? What else do we know about dark matter? That we learned in this course last week. How else we can constrain dark matter? Yeah, so you can constrain dark matter from the relic abundance measurement of WMAP. You can also constrain dark matter in other ways.
John? I don't know.
I don't know. You don't remember. You said you don't remember. Okay, so we have constraints on dark matter, very important constraints from direct detection. Okay? Direct detection are these underground experiments waiting for dark matter to hit a nuclei. Okay, so we have strong constraints from direct detection, and one of them, or the most important one nowadays, is CBMS, a cryogenic experiment waiting for dark matter to hit something. Okay, so these guys didn't use any constraints from CDMS, direct detection. So what direct detection is trying to do is searching for the couplings of dark matter directly into standard model particles. So from these two possibilities, Pierre Winot or Higgs Winot, which one do you think is going to be more constrained by direct detection? Yes. Strong, yes, very good, Elizabeth. Right. Okay, so yes, the Pierre-Wino Higgsino is very, very constrained by CDMS. So this idea of the fine-tuned or well-tempered neutralino, if you use direct detection constraints, also fades out. It is very difficult to come out with a combination of these two because these guys, are very constrained by direct detection. All right, so that was this paper. Let's continue with supersymmetry. Do you have any questions about the paper? You didn't read. All right. But you have all the, if you just read again the notes of past week, you have all the tools to understand some of the physics here. You know about, for example, yesterday we were talking about a global symmetry that is spontaneously broken. Of course we get Goldstone bosons. We did a tutorial about that. All these things are there. You just have to read them and ask me questions and work a little bit on that. Okay, so now, yesterday we were talking about supersymmetry breaking in the hope that if we describe how supersymmetry is broken explicitly, we are going to get away from these 124 new parameters of the MSSM. So we specify the mechanism of breaking of supersymmetry, maybe we will get more predictive. So let's see how we do that. We were talking about how supersymmetry can be broken by an F-term or an D-term. So there is a nice thing about supersymmetry. You can define what is called a supertrace. And the definition is, you take, for example, the supertrace of a mass matrix, and it's going to be defined as the sum over all the eigenvalues. Right. But now, this sum, this trace, is weighted based on the spin of the particle. So you know supersymmetry has, it relates fermions and bosons. So when you take a super trace, you also have to take into account the spin of the particle. This is the definition. Okay, so I, in this case, it can be, for example, it can be talking about fermions. In that case, this Ci is 1 or 2, depending on the Majorana or Dirac. Right? And the Ci is defined for bosons as, in this case, 1 for real bosons and 2 for complex. So you see, Ci is just counting the degrees of freedom. So this is the definition of the supertrace. Now, we are describing the MSSM as a bunch of chiral plus vector superfields or supermultiples, right? What it means is that in the chiral we have a fermion and a scalar. In the vector we have a gauge boson and a gaugeino. So there is a very nice rule about the supertrace in supersymmetry when you take this trace over the whole MSSM. The supertrace, and this I don't have, is a long derivation. So I will just write it down. It's a long derivation. But at the end of the day, you get that the supertrace, when you have chiral and vector superfields, is simply 3 times the trace of your vector boson, right? Plus trace of the scalar minus 2 times trace of the fermion. That's just using this formula, the definition, but in the case of chiral plus vector superfields, this is equal to a very simple expression. I think it's a minus trace of the A. and then the expectation value of the data. All right, so let's look at this. This is telling you what are the typical masses of your vector bosons, plus of the scalars minus the fermions. This is going to be something proportional to this trace and to the determined expectation value. So this expression of the supertrace is valid when we are breaking a spontaneously supersymmetry, like we are doing here. TA is the generator of U1 or SUN. Yes, we are going to talk about that. Yes, precisely, precisely, yes. Okay, so that's the expression in general. So you see, we get SUSY. To obtain the expression, we just assume there is SUSY breaking spontaneously by F and or DVFs. And this is the expression we obtain. So what are the possibilities? Well, the supertrace of M squared is zero in the SUSY preserving limit, of course, because this is zero. The supertrace of M squared is zero when we do Stern breaking. So adding supersymmetry breaking with an F-term is not contributing to this term here, to the supertrace. This is still zero. And what about in the term breaking? So the supertrace of M squared is still zero when there is the term breaking. Because the trace of these generators in any non-abelian theory is zero. So this is zero for non-abelian. And this is zero for non-anomalous U1. And this is something you did yesterday. So in your exercises, you looked at different anomalies. One of them was the anomaly of the U1 with gravitational legs. And to cancel the gravitational anomaly, you had a condition that the trace of TA for the U1 has to be zero. It's a condition, or the hypertrace had to be zero. It's a condition for non-anomalies. So this requirement that the supertrace is zero holds for, of course, the SUSY limit, F-term and D-term breaking, unless we have a U1, and this U1 is anomalous. See, the only way to get non-zero supertrace is to have a U1 and an anomalous U1. So if this anomalous U1 talks to any of our standard model, the hypercharge, we are in real trouble if there is any kind of kinetic mixing of these two. Because you know that an anomaly in our gauge U1 would be really bad. So the lesson of all this is to say it is very difficult after breaking supersymmetry to mess around with this relation. Okay, so let's see the consequences of this relation, that the supertrace of M squared is zero. Let's do that. The conclusion in U1. And it is hard to get supertrace of M squared different from zero. All right. the super trace is roughly giving you the masses, square masses of bosons minus square masses of fermions. Right? And these are, in this case, are supersymmetric bosons and supersymmetric fermions. So in the MSSM, where is the, who are the fermions in the, MSSM? These extra fermions. Gaijinos, cool. Anybody else? Higginos. And what about the scalars? What extra scalars we are adding to the standard model? Exactly, so it's leptons and it's quarks. On the partners of the leptons and quarks, yes. So the thing to realize is that there are many more bosons than fermions that you are adding. There are many more degrees of freedom, of bosonic degrees of freedom than fermionic degrees of freedom. So you start counting here, you get of order 70 new degrees of freedom, whereas this is order 10. So you want everybody in the MSSM to get heavy, all these leptons, quarks, gaijinos, and higginos to get heavy. What will be your prediction, naive prediction for the super trace? It should be positive, negative? Yes, yeah. You need everybody to get masses. If they are more or less of the same order, you need to increase 70 guys and increase 10. And there is a minus sign. So this, in a supersymmetric breaking scenario, you probably want super trace of M squared to be positive. Whereas one the condition that we just saw is that the super trace is very hard to get from being zero. Okay, so that's one thing. It's hard to obtain something different from zero, but what you would like to do is to obtain something positive. But it's even worse than that. Because, of course, this super trace contains every boson and every fermion in the MSSM. But this... conditions also contain subconditions inside. For example, when I write down that the mass of the leptons equals some mass of fermions, I have to include that there are some conserved quantum numbers. Oh, for example, if I look at the lepton number for the electron, and I look at the content of lepton number in this equation, I get a subset of conditions, and I get that super trace of m squared equals zero tells me that the mass of this electron left plus the mass of this electron right has to be equal twice the mass of the electron. So this is one condition that is a balance between a bunch of guys, but in this balance there are some subset of conditions that you can impose because you know there are conserved numbers, like lepton number. So this condition concerns lepton number. All right, so how does this look? Does it sound reasonable, Joel? Yeah, go. So in this case, I have a very long list of different particles that had to, whose masses had to cancel with each other. And I'm just saying, if I just look at one conserved number, for example, lepton number for the electron, I can pick one particular condition. This is one condition. So what I'm saying is that whatever the mass of this electron that I have here, it has to be equal to the mass of the electron. Sorry. Did I get them? Yes. So Joel, again, how does it look? So this the mass of the electron is roughly
ME.
Yes, ME this, right? Okay, great. And that would mean that the mass of the there is no possible cancellation here. So the mass of this electron has to be order ME this. So we are excluded, right? Because there are no electrons at the ME scale, because those electrons talk to the photons and we know very well there is no electron out there. So that sounds very, very bad. So we really need to get away from this condition that the supertrace is equal to zero. Okay? So the why not is because there is data out there that's not. All right. So let's try to modify this. So you see, now we have to break supersymmetry. A supersymmetry is so predictive that tells us, even when you break supersymmetry spontaneously, there are still relations, like this supertrace equals zero, that are very restrictive. Yes?
So if the selectron really was so light, would we have seen it in everyday life? Like, would the atom have looked different?
So you will have that this electron has the same quantum numbers as the electron, right? Except the spin. Meaning that it couples to the photon with the same strength as the electron. You will have a bunch of photons with electron. That would it would be screwing up everything, yes.
It can also both condense as well, so you'd be in real trouble. It can condense, it's a boson, not a fermion, so it can actually condense in.
If you had strong interactions.
You're lucky that you don't. I mean, for electron, you have the equivalent. Principle, has it called? The exclusion principle.
Yeah.
But all these electrons just pile in on top of each other, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, it will change the vacuum structure of what we see now. So yeah, that's pretty excluded. New light particles that couple with that strength to the photon? No. Okay. So we are in an impasse now. We need to get away from this relation in supersymmetry. And it is not easy to do that. So the idea is to use a hidden sector. Yes?
So I guess normal
is U1 doesn't work? Yes, normal is U1, non-anomalous U1, everything seems to be very difficult. So, but notice that when we obtain this relation, supertrace of M squared equals zero, first, this is a three-level relation. And second, this relation was assuming just the MSSM. Yes. You see, you can put the 124 parameters you can add, and still you cannot get away from that.
What's
that one? Yeah. So, as I said, to derive this is very long.
Right.
But even if you assume the most general mass terms, you still get this relation. That's because all the couplings of fermions to bosons are related by supersymmetry.
Yes. Right. But, like, if I could take any mass, I don't see how that relationship could possibly exist because I'll just change the mass a little bit such as supertrace.
So, even in the Carrel-Shapper multiplet, do you remember when we wrote down the Carrel guy? We wrote down the potential for the scalars. You see it? So, that there you will have possible masses for the scalars. But when you write what is the mass for the fermions? It's the same.
Oh, okay.
So you are too constrained.
So then the MSSM, if you're just putting in any old kind of mass terms, they have to follow from the supertension.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. That makes
So the idea is that the we are assuming that we are making supersymmetry spontaneous. That's a big assumption.
Oh, so wait, what's, so those aren't soft Susie breaking terms?
So at the end of the day, this soft Susie breaking term should come from a spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry. So the F term becomes an F, and then we get some terms over here. But even in that case, supersymmetry is so constrained, it's so much symmetry, that you get that.
Okay, so it's, we are spontaneously breaking this or something.
Yes.
Okay, is it true that that's soft symmetry breaking? I thought soft symmetry breaking is just putting in a few mass terms here and there.
Yes, you're right. So soft supersymmetry breaking is just putting by hands and terms.
Oh, okay.
But the assumption is that we want it spontaneously breaking.
Okay, so we've moved on from that.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And then, well, we are going to obtain these soft breaking terms right now, using that.
Wait, if there's soft breaking terms, what's the definition of soft breaking? Is it that we put them in by hand, or is that they come from spontaneous?
So let me give you an example. Look at the standard model.
Yeah.
And if you look at the after-electrovic symmetry breaking, the Lagrangian of the standard model is not the same as before-electrovic symmetry breaking. Why is that? Exactly. We shift everything,
yeah.
Induces masses for the W's and the Z's.
Yeah.
So if you just look at the Lagrangian, it looks like you've broken the symmetry.
It's still symmetry in theory, though.
Yes. So all the terms that break the symmetry in the standard model are proportional to the depth of the Higgs. And what I'm saying here is the same. So you break supersymmetry spontaneously with a bev of the F term, for example, and you will induce terms that break the symmetry. So the Lagrangian is not apparent that you have this symmetry, but they are proportional to the F term.
Okay.
So that's the same
so
idea.
So I was wrong to think that there's people out there that just take, like, for every particle, there's some other particle, and that's got some mass. Like there, that doesn't really ever happen. There's always some sort of spontaneous.
If you want to be predicted, yes.
Right.
But you could also take the approach, the phenomenological approach, of saying, I know nothing,
right.
And just put that.
So, right, some people specify Susie breaking.
Yes, so what we are trying to do now is to specify Susie breaking.
Right.
And even before just explaining how we do it, how we break supersymmetry, we are encountering some problems.
Because now we're assuming there's a mechanism, and this mechanism constrains.
But we haven't defined anything about the mechanism besides being spontaneous.
Right. Okay, that's, so it's very general.
Yes, exactly. So now we want to get away from this super trace being zero. Yes.
I'm a bit confused about the tree level. I was saying that so far all the masses haven't received any corrections from randomization.
Yes.
But since we assume super symmetry is spontaneous breaking, so we still have the selectron mass is much bigger than the electron mass.
No, that's precisely the problem. When we assume a spontaneous breaking, so F or the E terms, then we have this relation, and then you have this prediction. The selectron and the electron are of the same mass. So,
but we should have the selectron. I mean,
that's a phenomenological constraint. That's what data is telling us. Nature is not supersymmetric. This is not reality. We have to get away from that. But if you just assume a spontaneous supersymmetry breaking, you get that, and that's trouble. So we are trying to move away from that. So how do we mess around with this relation? First of all, is that we obtain an if. This long derivation is just using the true-level relations of masses for the scalars and masses for the fermions. But of course, you can use loops to break down these relations. So, you are assuming true-level, loops will accept this condition. And also, when we write these kind of things, specific relations between masses of standard model particles and the partners, we are assuming there is nothing else but the MSSM. So we come out and say, oh, well, so let's assume there is more stuff out there. Besides the MSSM, there is something else. Then we may be able to upset these kind of relations. So let's do that. This is called the hidden sector. We do need a hidden sector in the MSSM to get away from this prediction. So the hidden sector picture is to have a hidden sector that breaks supersymmetry. So in the hidden sector, there is a breaking of supersymmetry. And somehow, this breaking of supersymmetry is transmitted to the MSSM. The usual ways to do that are, these guys talk to the MSSM through gravitational interactions. So 1 over M Planck interactions. And this is called the supergravity mediation. So that's one possibility. My hidden sector talks to the MSSM only through gravitational interactions, supergravity interaction. That's called supergravitation. Other possibilities is that the transmission happens through gauge interactions or gauge loops. This is called gauge mediation. Or anomaly mediation. And we are going to talk about these different proposals. So, you can invent a bunch of different hidden sectors and different ways to communicate supersymmetry breaking to the MSSM. And each of them will give a different prediction for the MSSM supersymmetry breaking terms. I don't want to discuss some of this for a long time because at the end of the day, you may have many mechanisms in place, and all these predictions for one single mechanism are not going to hold in nature. So I'm just going to give you a rough view of the different mechanisms without details. Yeah. Yes, it is, indeed. I mean, you see, we are always cornered to do something else, engineering, always engineering. But that's...
So, I mean, the MSSM is probably the least realistic model of supersymmetry from a mathematical point of view. Like, you're constraining it a lot and you're adding extra stuff just to make it work.
But you could do worse than that. You could do, instead of n equals one supersymmetry, you could do 4 or 8 supersymmetries, right? And be even more constrained. So, yeah, I agree. It sounds very constraining.
Doing the minimal thing we can, it's a minimal supersymmetric standard model. So
yes.
We're just taking the standard model matter and just giving everything a superpart.
And you know, we always want to do this Occam razor type of, you know, analysis, saying the simplest must be true. That's what Einstein says, it must be true. Sometimes it doesn't work. So at this stage, we are breaking supersymmetry, and we need to add not only a hidden sector, but also a way of communicating between the two. And this is what defines the different mechanisms for supersymmetry breaking. So let's do that. So this hidden sector is hidden because it has superscapings. Like in the case of M. Planck, the supergravitation, or because the communication is only through loops, as in the case of gauge mediation. So what are these different mechanisms of supersymmetry breaking? Doing D-term breaking is very hard, and that's why there are very few models out there with D-term breaking. But you know why? It's because it is very difficult to come up with a U1 that is anomalous, gets a BEV, and never talks to our nice U1 gauge symmetries in the standard model. So those kind of models are hard to do. And the simplest models are based on F-turn braking. So you remember we say that the potential is F tilde plus this gauge here. So what are the dimensions of F? Mass dimensions. Or what is the dimension of the potential? To what power? When I ask the dimensions, I mean what is the power in mass that they have. So potential is m squared phi squared or lambda phi 4. So it has... Yes. So it's 4 because it's lambda phi 4 and every phi has dimension 1. Yes. So this has dimensions of 4. So the F mass dimensions is 2. All right? What am I telling you this? It's because you can always do dimension analysis for everything. So let's discuss the different supersymmetry braking sectors. One proposal is gravity mediation. Gravity mediation is have the hidden sector talks to 1 over n Planck suppressed interactions to the MSSR. So the soft masses that you are going to generate using this complicated mechanism are going to be, they have to be proportional to the breaking of supersymmetry, right? And inversely, and they also have to be proportional to 1 over n Planck, because when I send n Planck to infinity, I don't have any communication. All right? So, roughly, you will think that this has to be proportional to F, and also to 1 over n Planck. If there is no n Planck interactions, I don't get anything. If I send this F term to 0, I don't get anything, any breaking of supersymmetry. So at least the way this shows up makes sense. Is it dimensionally correct? Cool. Okay. So next guy is gauge mediation. Same story, hidden sector. Now it talks to through gauge interactions and loops to the MSSM. Okay, so we want to know what is the typical soft masses. Well, because it comes through loops, I need alpha over 4 pi. This is my loop factor. Okay? And now if I just do like this, it's not dimensionally correct. Right? It's too many powers of it. The important component here in gauge mediation is that it's talking, the hidden sector talks to the MSSM through loops, but there are loops of what? There are loops of new particles called messengers. So what before was 1 over n Planck suppressed interactions, now is 1 over m mass of the messengers suppressed interactions. If I send the messengers to infinity, I don't get anything. There is no communication. And if I send F to 0, there is no supersymmetry breaking. So you want to generate...
Like how much of these hidden sectors do you specify?
Not much.
Right.
Yes. So especially in this case. So in these two cases, you say, there is a hidden sector, it breaks somehow supersymmetry. That in the case of the messengers in principle are supersymmetric supermultiplex. So you have same masses for fermions and bosons, but then they feel supersymmetry breaking, and they talk about supersymmetry breaking to the MSSM through loops. Yes, that we generally don't specify.
But it's not happening in the hidden sector.
It is happening in the hidden sector.
Oh, okay, as well.
Yes, so the hidden sector breaks Susie. The picture is always here with
right.
Susie.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you said, yeah.
Then this Susie breaking is communicated to the MSSM, but we want a suppressed communication.
Communicated.
Through M-blank.
So you stick in some couplings between like the gravitino of the hidden sector and the MSSM?
For example.
Or between the...
Or the hidden sector, like Susie, talks to the messengers, and the messengers talk to the MSSM. But there is never direct communication between the two of them. They had to go through a loop of messengers.
Could you draw the diagram maybe?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Have the
diagram.
So...
Let's
see if I'm able. So we want to generate... Let's do a scale, it's easier. You think? Yes. So, in this case, we want a fermion. Alright. So, these are my messengers that talk through gauge interactions to gauginos. And these messengers, for example, they talk to the hidden sector, and the hidden sector made them break supersymmetry. So they know that the fermion here and the scalar here have different masses. So the fact that these are a scalar of a messenger scalar and a messenger fermion. And the messengers talk to us, to the MSSM. And the way we know that there is supersymmetry breaking is that these messengers talked already to the hidden sector, which shifted the masses of the fermion and the scalar. So all these two loops of these two guys having different mass, we are getting any effect. So it's loop suppressed, and it's proportional to this, but also it contains a mass of the messengers suppressing there. Because if we send these guys to be very, very heavy, this loop is decouples. Yes. Yes, exactly. And it's model dependent. It's model dependent. So, I've done that. You sit down and you do your, you want to maintain unification, so your messenger sector should be SU5 multiplex, complete multiplex. So you write down what is their model content that is able to do that and get unification. And then you do it. It's not fun, but what matters is that the way you generate these submasses is always parametrically dependent on F and inversely dependent on whatever is communicated. In the case of gauge, you have a loop factor, but there is no more difference than that. Okay. These are the two main proposals. There is also anomaly mediation, gauge-chino mediation, whatever. Probably there are 15 models out there of how to break supersymmetry. Doesn't matter. So let's do some numbers about this. So we want M soft to be of order the electroweak scale, right? So in the case of supergravity, that tells you that the F term for the gravity mediation. You plug here 100 GeVs, you plug here 10 to the 18 GeVs, and then that you get that the F term for supergravity, this guy, should be of order 10 to the 10 GeVs. So the scale of supersymmetry in supergravity is very high, 10 to the 10 GeVs. So 10 to the 18, 10 to the 2, square root of that, 10 to the 10. Now, you do exactly the same. You 100th here, and then you say, I want the messenger scale and the F term to be same order, then you get that square root of F for gauge mediation is much lower, it's order 10 to the 4 GeV's. So, the conclusion is that if you do models of gravity mediation, your scale of supersymmetry breaking is very high. And why do we see supersymmetry breaking at the order 100 GeV's? It's because the way this very high scale is communicated to us is through Planck interactions, and those are very suppressed. So you are breaking a lot supersymmetry to the scale of 10 to the 10, but the way it's communicated to you seems to be 10 to the 2 GeV's, electroweak scale. How does it work here? Well, so you have a new sector, this messenger sector, is order 10 TeV, and the scale of supersymmetry breaking is of the same order. So scale supersymmetry breaking is close to you. It's only one loop above from the electroweak scale. So the only suppression you are getting is a loop. And that's why it happens to be 100 times bigger than the electroweak scale. Well, we expect to see a lot of supersymmetric particles at the electroweak scale, and effects not as, like 10 TeV is not accessible at the energy. The reason is that you have an energy of order square root of n is 14 TeV, but this is the typical, the average energy that you get from this collider is of order 0.1. This square root of S. So the typical parton energy, like you give this proton 14 TeV, the typical parton that will collide will have order 1 or 2 TeV. But the PDS are exponential, right?
Oh.
So it's
But if you could make a 100 TeV or 1,000 TeV collider, then, in principle, you could start probing this hidden sector. You could start directly creating messengers.
But we don't need that. We don't need a collider because we know that there are already a lot of bounds on the messenger scale from flavor-changing neutral currents. Those, you remember, past week we saw that the scale for flavor-changing neutral currents and contact interactions, those bounds are already hundreds of TeV. So you already know something about these high scales from flavor physics, but you won't be able to probe them in the LHC at least. Oh, it's already there. Okay. So let's just finish supersymmetry by saying what are the predictions of supersymmetry. Let's recap. So, when you talk to your experimental colleagues and they ask you, where is the prediction, when I'm going to see in the LHC that will tell me there is supersymmetry out there, what do you think that you will tell them? New particles? Okay, a bunch of new particles. Can you tell them something about the spin of these particles? Like, for example, you know that from the gluon you have a gluino. This is spin 1, this is spin 0. Thank you. So it's a fermion, right? So the gluino is a fermion. I will see a color particle, massive, and it's a fermion. It behaves like a gluino. So you are able to measure the spin, you will know that it's some kind of supersymmetry. You see a bunch of fermions and scalars that behave exactly as the scalars and fermions of the standard model.
Yeah, that's the scalars.
Lots of color scalars, yes. Color meaning that they have strong interactions. And because they have strong interactions, they will be copiously produced at the LHC. So lots of scalars that are color, a strong production of scalars. What else do you think you can tell them? But what would you tell them about the LSP, the light supersymmetric particle? Okay, that's a step farther than. Okay, so the light supersymmetric particle is what? The dark matter candidate is what? Neutral. So it is not detected. What else? It is stable, so it doesn't decay. What it means is that typically, let's say I produce a bunch of these color scalars and a quark and a quark, and the guy is going to decay, but at the end of the day, well, in this case, at the end of the day I had to end up in the dark matter candidate. So my supersymmetric particles will decay all the way until they arrive to the lightest supersymmetric particle. And this guy is stable, is neutral, it just flies off the detector. And because it flies off the detector doesn't detect anything. The way you infer that there was dark matter is because they look at the energy distribution, they know how much energy they put here, and there is nothing coming out. So they call that missing energy. So they will see signatures of missing energy. That's the way they will discover dark matter, is to not see anything, dark and missing energy. What else do you think you can tell them? What about the Higgs? What do we know about the Higgs? There will be two, it's a two Higgs doublet model. So not only two, but you have two Higgs doublet model. You will find your standard model Higgs, some heavy Higgs, the pseudoscalar Higgs, and then the charged Higgs. So the Higgs sector is much more interesting and rich in the MSSN than in the standard model. And we also know that in supersymmetry it's not just a two Higgs doublet model, there are also relations of these couplings. So one way you will tell your experimental colleagues is to say, okay, go look for these Higgses, measure the couplings very well, and then you will know if it's really a supersymmetric two Higgs doublet model. Okay, so you can think on other ways of discovering supersymmetry, but those are the simplest ones. Missing energy, lots of color particles, a particular two Higgs doublet model. So we are done. Tomorrow we'll start the extra dimensions. Any questions, by the way?